from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Robert Rubin helped steer the U.S. economy during the Clinton boom years as Secretary of Treasury. Now, from the sidelines, he's sounding off about President Bush's economics. Tonight on Point, Robert Rubin on tax cuts and the federal deficit and how, he says, they will come back to bite. First, a report that the nation's factories were revving up in November. Statistics released yesterday chart an impressive surge in manufacturing output, orders, and expectations of growth to come. I asked Greg Ipp of the Wall Street Journal why there's so much excitement about the new numbers.
Well, Tom, after a very long period of extremely miserable growth, it looks like our hard-hit manufacturing sector is coming back quite strong. A regular survey of purchasing managers in the manufacturing sector in the month of November found the highest level of activity since 1983, back when the big Reagan recovery was in full swing. And even more impressive were the data on things like new orders, which were also at the highest level in about 20 years. And perhaps the most encouraging sign of light in this survey was that we are hearing that these firms are planning to increase their payrolls for the first time in 3 years. As you'll recall, we've had a very poor recovery in employment, the jobless or even job loss recovery, it's been called. And by far the hardest hit area has been the industrial sector, which has been cutting jobs almost nonstop for 3 years. So if in fact we have turned the corner and we are starting to increase factory jobs in the current period, that's got to be encouraging for anybody who cares about the job situation out there.
And is this specific to certain industries, or is it right across the board?
It is clearly across the board, Tom. Of the 20 industries that the survey looked at, 18 reported growth. So that's pretty darn good.
18 out of 20. That's just about everything. Now, what about employment? Have we seen firm figures yet? I think the next big numbers come out on Friday. What are the indicators there?
You're right. The Bureau of Labor Statistics will tell us how overall employment did in the month of November. That'll be on Friday. The expectation from economists is that we will see an increase in non-farm payrolls of 150,000. Now, that would probably be the best number we've had in over a year, and it would seem like very good news. But I should caution you that it's only roughly the same number of people who enter the workforce every month just through natural population growth to look for new jobs. So it doesn't actually help us soak up any of the people who have lost their jobs because of the weak recovery and the recession in the last 3 years. Put another way, we're probably not going to see any significant downward move in the unemployment rate. So while the employment situation definitely continues to pick up, as yet we do not have the evidence to suggest that it's creating a lot of comfort for those who lost their jobs in the last few years.
Greg, what's driving the manufacturers to crank up their plants and output again? Where's the demand?
I think the real question is, why was it so weak for so long? I mean, this recovery should have begun roughly at the end of 2001. It's almost 2 years later, and traditionally you would have been running on all cylinders long ago. And the question is, why did it take so long? Well, we had so many shocks. We had, first of all, the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in 2001 to deal with. We had a series of corporate scandals, and then we had the very long build-up to the war in Iraq. And those things all just reduced confidence among consumers and among businesses. I think what you're seeing now is partly people starting to make investments in machinery and equipment and to build up inventories that they had been postponing month after month for a very long time. So to a great extent, Tom, what you're seeing now basically is a return to normal levels of activity as people scramble to catch up with all the production and investment and all those things that they have put off for so long. I think there are a couple of reasons to suggest it will continue for a little while. First of all, inventories, the amount of stuff that are on companies' shelves, are at very low levels. And so as these new orders come in, that forces companies to crank up the production lines, both to meet the new orders and to build up inventories again. And out there, the conditions for the economy look, you know, pretty positive. Interest rates are still low. The Fed is in all likelihood going to leave them alone next week when they meet. Stock prices are up strongly this year, and banks have lots of money to lend. These very positive, constructive financial conditions are all encouraging continued growth. And of course, if indeed the employment creation continues, as we think it will, that will put more money in the pockets of households to keep on spending.
Greg, if everything's headed toward gangbusters, how long can the Fed keep interest rates at these rock-bottom levels?
It's a great question, Tom. I think the Fed can continue to keep interest rates quite low for a long time for a couple of reasons. Number one, even though the economy is growing quickly, it has not grown enough yet to use up all the slack that was created by the very, very soft conditions of the prior 2 years, and is the amount of slack that tends to continue to put downward pressure on prices and wages. And the second reason that they can continue to be patient is that the inflation rate is still very low. It's below 1.5%. And if you ask some of Fed officials, they'd say that's actually getting a bit too low for them. So they will not be in panic mode if there starts to be a little bit upward creep in the inflation rate. That is very different from a decade ago when inflation was around 3 or 4%, which was too high for them. And they were very quick to start to take their foot off the accelerator and raise interest rates once the economy established a firm footing.
And finally, how about the two big deficits out there, the federal budget deficit headed toward $500 billion or something like that, the trade deficit, which is something like the same scale. How do those factor in here?
Two separate issues. The trade deficit, Tom, I think is something that's been a problem for a while, but I think it's in the process of slowly correcting itself. That's because, first of all, the dollar has been declining for some time, and that will very slowly start to improve the competitiveness of our manufacturers versus foreign competitors. And the other thing is that with a little bit more time, I think economic conditions will improve in Europe, in Japan, in Asia, and they will be buying more products from the United States. That will help the trade deficit. I wish I could be as optimistic about the budget deficit, but I simply am not. It's really a mess. We have both an administration and a Congress that are scrambling to see who can cut taxes and spend more money faster than the other. Fiscal discipline has completely gone out the window. It will be a miracle if the deficit is materially below $500 billion in the current fiscal year. And we are still 5 or 6 years away from the really big problem on the deficit, which is when the baby boomers, people like you and I, start to retire and demand like a lot more services in terms of Social Security and Medicare. Not only have we completely failed to deal with that coming tidal wave of spending pressures, we've actually just gone and created a brand new open-ended entitlement, a drug benefit, with absolutely no concept of how we're going to control the cost. I'm afraid, Tom, it's bad news and more bad news on the budget deficit front.
Greg Ipp, thanks for joining us.
Okay, Tom.
Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from New York. Robert Rubin is widely heralded as one of the world's top economic minds. He spent 26 years on Wall Street at Goldman Sachs, rising to co-chairman. President Clinton appointed him director of the newly formed National Economic Council in 1993, and in 1995, Rubin became Treasury Secretary. He helped guide the longest economic expansion in U.S. history and avert crises from Mexico to Asia. He was part of what Time magazine called the Committee to Save the World, with Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan and his then-deputy, now president of Harvard University, Larry Summers. Tonight on Point, Robert Rubin on the economy then and now and his tough choices in an uncertain world. Did Robert Rubin have it right in the 1990s, pushing to balance the budget, open markets, and acknowledge America's interest in boosting the rest of the world? Were you a fan of Robert Rubin? Does the Bush administration need a dose of Rubinomics or something new? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin. He spent 26 years at Goldman Sachs, was co-chair when he left in 1993. From 93 to 95, he was director of the newly formed National Economic Council under Bill Clinton. From 1995 to 1999, he was Secretary of the Treasury. He went to Citigroup, the world's largest financial services firm, in 1999, where he is a director and keeps his offices today. His new book is In an Uncertain World, Tough Choices from Wall Street to Washington. Good evening and welcome, Robert Rubin.
Good evening. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you so much for joining us, for being with us. Your timing has often been good, and it was sure good in getting out of town in 1999, Robert Rubin. The market bust began the next year. I wonder if you would – there's so much we want to ask you tonight, and I know you've got a big critique of deficits and a lot that's going on now. We want to learn more about your own biography. It's fascinating, actually. But if I wish you'd take us on a little tour first of the arc of the U.S. economy as you were leaving Washington and the Clinton administration in 1999 through the bust to where we are today. How do you describe what happened in that 4 years?
I think I put it this way very briefly, Tom. We had remarkable economic conditions in the 1990s, as I think you said, the longest expansion in American economic history. I think policy was very central to that, including restoration of fiscal discipline. But by the time you got to the end of that period, and I think this has always been true when you've had extended good times, imbalances had started to develop, high levels of consumer debt, corporate debt, the trade deficit, which you and Greg mentioned, excess capacity and the stock market that went to very high levels by any historical standard. And that, it seems to me, and I actually wrote a piece in, I think it was February 2000, the Financial Times, about this, then looking forward from then, it led inevitably to a difficult period. In my view, at least, the policy responses to that difficult period were far from what I think they should have been. But in any event, we had a difficult period. We now have enormous stimulus in the system from the Fed, from defense and homeland security spending, from that portion of the tax cuts that come into this period. And I think it is likely, I agree with Greg, I think it is likely that we will continue to have strong growth at least through the second quarter of next year, which is when these when the stimulus peters out, and then after that it may continue on its own or it may not. The problem is we could have had every bit of the stimulus that was desired in the short term with temporary tax cuts instead of the program that we had, and we would have had far more cost-efficient stimulus, and much more importantly, we would have avoided this enormous contribution that the tax cuts made to these horrendous long-term deficits that Greg referred to, I think are a very, very serious long-term threat to our economy. And we didn't need to do that. We could have had all the short-term stimulus we wanted without those long-term effects.
We're going to come back and look at Bush economic policy in some detail with you, Robert Rubin. But let me ask you first, what the bust in 2000 and its aftermath, what does that bust, the way that longest boom in U.S. economic history, say about the Clinton boom or the Robert Rubin boom or the Greenspan boom, whatever you want to call it? What did the denouement say about the run-up and the climax?
Yeah, I don't think it says anything, Tom, that we shouldn't all have seen. As I said, I did write a piece in the FT and the Financial Times in February of 2000, sort of talking about what I thought was a prospect for this kind of a thing. There is, seems to be a tendency in human nature to go to excess. And I think there was a lot of talk toward the end, if you may remember, toward the end of the 90s about we have a new economy, we've done away with business cycles. I thought it was all absurd. And I think that the lesson of that period is we did have a remarkable set of economic conditions, and the American people are far better off today than they would have been without it.
Was there a way in policy terms, Robert Rubin, that you could have, you know, drug one foot out the car door more effectively to keep that going, or is this just an inevitable boom-bust? You know, surely we're learning through these cycles one after the other.
Yeah, we learn through the cycles, but I think one of the things we learn is that cycles are probably inevitable. I don't think that there's anything significant, and I've thought a lot about. I don't think there's anything significant that we could have done. Some people say Greenspan should have had a somewhat different set of monetary policies, but I don't personally agree with that. Some people say that the Treasury or the Fed should have warned people that the market was too high, but I think that's an horrendous idea to have the public officials issuing market warnings. I think it would create chaos. So, no, I actually don't think that there's – I think that we can learn to have good fiscal policy and good monetary policy, but even if we do all that, I think inevitably from time to time there will be excesses and there will be cycles.
Okay, and now we look at a $500 billion U.S. federal budget deficit. Where is that taking us?
Oh, no, it's much worse than that. That is the what people expect the deficit in this current year to be.
Yes.
And given the excess capacity that we have, I think it's probably appropriate to have a substantial deficit now. I don't think that's where the problem lies. I think the problem lies in that most budget analysts now project the 10-year deficit, for the U.S. economy, somewhere between $5 and $5.5 trillion. Goldman Sachs put out a report, I don't remember, maybe a week or two ago, saying that if anything, the risk on that is on the upside. And the first line they had in the report is the budget's out of control. And unfortunately, I think that's probably right.
Where does that take the U.S. economy?
I think at some point, and it's no way to predict when, but at some point, I think that will almost surely lead to very substantially higher interest rates. I think it runs a real risk of undermining business and consumer confidence, and I think it could easily undermine international the confidence in national markets in our currency. You put it all together, and I think that at some point out there, we're going to pay the bill for having borrowed from the future to pay for the present.
A lot of Americans listening to this tonight may have lived through high interest rates before. Early 80s, you had, 15, 16, 17, 18% people were paying on different countries.
Well, what we had is, that actually was in the very late Carter administration and very early Reagan administration, you had very high interest rates. And as you may remember, we had a recession back then.
Yes, I did.
It had very serious impacts. And you kind of repeated that beginning in the middle of 1989. It took you through the very early 90s. And I think that was very much very high interest rates. And that, too, led to recession and difficult economic conditions. And I think that was a function of the fiscal policies of the 80s, which, as you remember, was a policy of continued deficits.
Robert Rubin, stand by. There's a lot we want to learn tonight. We're delighted to have you along. We're talking with former Clinton Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin. You can join the conversation. Did Robert Rubin have it right in the 1990s? Balance the budget, open market, see America's interest in the economies of the third world? Were you a fan of Rubinomics? Did it work for you or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former Clinton Secretary of the Treasury Robert Rubin. You can join the conversation. Are you nostalgic for the Clinton years? Do you resonate to that Robert Rubin's admiration for Bill Clinton? We'll hear more about that. And if Robert Rubin's tough critique of George W.'s economics is right, why is the economy surging back right now? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Rubin, my old friend David Warsh wrote in the New York Times review of books last weekend describing Rubinomics as having become a noun in common use denoting a set of economic policies either praised or blamed as the essence of the Clinton presidency. Don't be modest for a minute. How would you define Rubinomics?
Well, I wouldn't refer to Rubinomics, Tom. The term, I would call it the economic strategy that was created under leadership of President Clinton, but the term Rubinomics has come to mean something like your friend wrote in the New York Times, but basically I think it refers predominantly to a focus on long-term fiscal discipline, and it started when the Wall Street Journal editorial page, I think it was, criticized what they referred to as this strange view that deficits affect interest rates, even though that is the view of virtually all mainstream economists, and they called it Rubinomics. And some people in the administration started doing the same until they began to realize that when they used that term, it reminded people of the remarkably good economic conditions of the 90s, and they stopped using the term. That's what happened.
and it went away. But that's not all there is to it. I mean, you pushed very hard for open markets in the U.S. and around the world, clearly a key part there. I wonder if you see that push as I don't know, moving out of gear right now. There seems to be a kind of country sitting back on their haunches and thinking twice about everything.
Oh, I think it's very troubling, Tom. It's not just this country. There's a backlash. I think it's actually very troubling. There's a backlash, certainly in this country, but also around the world, against trade liberalization. I think it served our interest extremely well, and I think it's the right path to go forward. But if you look at the steel tariffs and the now these recent quotas on the Chinese textiles and the failure of this multilateral round called the Doha round to help developing countries come into the benefit more from trade. All this, plus the rhetoric in the Democratic primaries, all of it has a very anti-trade sound to it, and in some ways, in some cases, anti-trade actions. And I think it's very troubling.
You learned in your time in Washington, clearly from your book, In an Uncertain World, to see that there's more than just numbers at work in economic policy, that politics are very important. How do you interpret the backlash, Robert Rubin?
Oh, I think it's a little bit I heard your interview with Greg Ipp, and he is very thoughtful. I read his stuff all the time. I think that he had it about right. I think people are anxious about jobs. Clearly, as the range of goods and services subject to trade has widened, and it's widened a lot with a lot of service jobs now being outsourced to China and to India particularly, that's expanded the range of anxiety, and I think all of that is, particularly at a time when there's been a lot of job loss and so far at least not much job recovery, I think that that is contributed to and in fact is sort of at the core of this resurgence of protectionism or this backlash, if you will, against trade liberalization.
So in policy terms, how might that have been ameliorated? Was there a way to move down this path that would create less backlash? You know, what about the? I mean, people aren't kicking back just for no reason at all. It's not pure obstreperousness. People are feeling different kinds of pain and uncertainty and insecurity. Could those have been softened somehow?
Yeah, I think they could have been. I think at least two things come to mind, Tom. One is, I think if we had a different set of short-term stimuli in response to the difficult conditions once they had started, I think we probably could have had a shorter period and probably could have had a more favorable jobs effect. We certainly could have avoided the long-term deficits, but I think, or at least most of the long-term deficits, but I think we probably could have had more jobs effect as well. The second thing is, and a lot of people advocate trade liberalization forget this, but I think it's equally important, you've got to have a good public education system, you've got to have training, you've got to help for those who are dislocated because there will be dislocations from trade. And I don't think we've done as much of that as we should have. We tried in our administration. We were somewhat limited by the constraints of fiscal discipline, which are their absolute threshold issue. And we didn't do as much as we would have liked to, although we did a fair bit. And I think it's flagged since we left.
And what do you say to Americans who say, I bought that and I went out and I got a great education in computer programming that was supposed to be the future, and my job just got taken by somebody on the west coast of India? There seems to be, I can't run fast enough on this treadmill to keep ahead.
Well, I think to any given individual who gets hurt by trade, and there are, Tom, people get hurt by trade, far larger number of people, by the way, who get dislocated or hurt in some fashion by technology because of its increase in productivity and the displacement of people that creates. But there are people who are hurt by trade. On the other hand, there are vast numbers of people who are helped by trade. And I think in individual instances, there is real damage or real hurt to the individual, as you say. But the vast preponderance of effect is beneficial. But there, unfortunately, the people who receive the benefit very often don't identify it as a benefit or don't even see it as a benefit of trade or technology or change.
So we identify the downside but not the benefits.
I think we are very keenly cognizant of the dislocations, and I think very often really unaware of how much consumer prices have stayed down because of trade, or interest rates have stayed down because of trade, or competitiveness has improved because of the pressure of imports. That's correct.
You mix memoir and policy in your new book, written with Jacob Weisberg, in a very intimate way. I want to get just a little bit of sense here before we turn back to policy of where Robert Rubin came from. Your family knew something about dislocation, not from international trade, but you've got this one scene of your, as I recall, your grandfather driving to your father's graduation, driving up from Florida to your father's graduation from Columbia Law School, with a pistol in the glove box of his Chevrolet, debating whether or not to shoot himself on the way up. What was that about?
Well, that's right. My grandfather was an immigrant to this country. He left to Russia when he was 12 years old. He was drafted into the Tsar's army and decided that really was not a very promising career, which I suspect was a correct judgment. Mm-hmm. And he got out of there. He came here, he learned English, and he was very, very successful in business. And then the Depression came. They moved to Florida by that time. The Florida land bust and the Depression in quick succession, and it took away everything he had. My father was graduating from Columbia Law School in 1930, and my grandfather, as you correctly said, got in the car down in Miami to drive up, and he decided he either go to the graduation or he'd shoot himself. And he decided to go to the graduation, and it's a really remarkable story because he never did get his wealth back, but he also didn't care, and he developed a much healthier attitude toward life and lived to a ripe old age and a very good frame of mind.
On the other side of that long drive with the pistol, a kind of equanimity took hold.
In some place, he really went through some kind of a transformation, a psychological transformation, which was enormously to his benefit.
And what about that pivotal moment in your career, Robert Rubin, when you went from being a young lawyer, you'd come out of Harvard and Yale Law School, you were sitting, as I recall, at a meeting about a company called Comsat, they were going to go public, and you were watching the investment bankers in the room do their work as you sat in as an attorney, and you decided, sooner or later, I want to be one of those guys, one of those investment bankers. What was it about that world that drew you so?
Yeah, I think basically I have a very entrepreneurial sort of spirit, and I'm a fairly commercial kind of a person, and it's just a lot more interesting to me. I have enormous respect for people who practice law, and there's a great craftsmanship to the practice of law, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. I liked what looked to me like a more entrepreneurial and more spirited way of life that was on the other side of the table, and so I left a very wonderful law firm I was with and went to Goldman Sachs and Company.
And a lot of arbitrage later ended up in Washington. We're talking tonight with former Clinton Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Joseph is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Hi, Mr. Rubin. Thanks very much for coming on the show. My question is, what economic policies do you think the Bush administration or its successor can follow over the next 3 to 5 years to encourage economic development throughout the world?
Oh, there's a big question, and thanks for it, Joseph. Robert Rubin.
Well, I think there are at least two things that whoever is president of the United States should be doing. Number one, I think we should get our own fiscal house in order because the world depends on us having a strong economy. And I think unless we get our long-term fiscal house in order, we're going to have terrible problems here. So I think that's the single most important thing to do, and it's unfortunately not easy to do because we created such a deep hole for ourselves. And the second thing is I think we should very substantially, within the framework of that fiscal discipline, very substantially increase our assistance to foreign countries. It's only about, I think, 0.12% of our economy right now. So we could double or triple that. It would still be a very small number. And then we should use that to try to encourage good policy in those countries. So those are at least two things that it seems to me could be very helpful.
You've written, Robert Rubin, that you ran repeatedly up against public perception problems, that the interrelatedness of global economies is so great these days, and the need for U.S. involvement in developing countries in particular, where you point out 40% of U.S. exports go, it's very hard for people to sometimes understand what America's interests are in helping those economies to develop. You even wrote that you thought that the United States might need a kind of the equivalent of an anti-smoking campaign to promote education about this interrelatedness along those lines. What would the message of that campaign be?
I think the message would be what you just said, Tom, and that is that what's going to happen in this country economically is going to be enormously affected by what happens in the rest of the world, that we are not an island unto ourselves, and that we have a tremendous interest in combating poverty abroad and developing middle income populations abroad and in fostering a world of trade liberalization and free flows of investment, as well as, obviously, dealing with the geopolitical issues that have now become so important to our economy.
We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Robert Rubin. Bob is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Good evening. I have a question regarding whether or not the U.S. is losing its real authority in promoting orthodox policies around the world, just reflecting on the crises that happened during the 90s, and whether or not the current trends within the U.S. economy are really taking away the authority of the country that's really looked to as the kind of lender of last resort to bail out.
And what kind of authority in particular are you thinking of, Bob?
Well, just in terms of encouraging and pushing countries to develop liberalization policies, whether it's trade or whether it's capital flows, developing policies that have a track record of promoting growth, whether or not, because of our own fiscal problems, whether or not we're going to lose our voice in the world in promoting these kinds of ideals.
Got it. Thanks for your call, Bob. Robert Rubin.
Yeah, I think it's a very good question, actually. I went with President Clinton to the G7, that's the meeting of the heads of state of the seven leading industrial countries, to the G7 in Tokyo in 1993. And it was very interesting to see what happened. He was accorded great regard by the other leaders because he had led this country back into a path of fiscal discipline, and it had begun the recovery that then became this long period of sustained growth. And I do think that the manner in which he was regarded was very helpful in terms of this country providing leadership on a whole host of issues going forward. And I think, unfortunately, given our current fiscal path, I think there is a real danger that respect in which we have been held will be undermined and our ability to provide leadership will be undermined. I might add, I think our unilateralism cuts very much in the same direction. I think instead we should be on a path of multilateralism, working with others around the world, and whatever the issues may be.
Robert Rubin, we've had all kinds of economists on this program over the last year or so, very, very high-tier economists, Nobel Prize winners, and the conservatives that we have on poo-poo to a very significant extent the danger in the deficit. They say, come on, we will grow out of this. Get with the program. Where's your optimism? We've grown out of these problems before, and we'll grow out again if we just have faith and cut loose this magnificent American economic machine. What's your response?
Well, I think there are multiple responses, but very simply, if you look at the projections that firms like Goldman Sachs have made or independent analysts of all kinds have made with respect to this 10-year, $5.5 trillion projected deficit, those projections are based on the assumption of a very high rate of growth. They're based on the assumption that the economy will grow at what is called a full employment rate of growth, the highest rate of growth it can have without generating inflation. So that is already assuming a high rate of growth. I think, unfortunately, this policy of having very, or this consequence of having very large deficits is going to undermine the very growth that we need. So that I think it does the antithesis of what these people say. And in fact, if you look at the 80s, we had a long period of very high deficits, and that led not to more growth, but it led ultimately to the recession and then the difficult economic conditions of the very early 90s.
So are you suggesting that the potential problems ahead are similar in scale and seriousness to the recession at the turn of that decade, or might there be something more difficult out there?
You know, it's hard to know what form they will take or what the magnitude will be, but I think that this is actually a more serious set of problems. And again, I think Greg mentioned this. The baby boomers start retiring toward the end of this decade, but what really happens is somewhere around 2014 or thereabouts, the retirements accelerate at a very rapid rate. And if you look at projections of deficits going forward, what you see is that, as I said, the projection is about $5.5 trillion or so for the next 10 years. But then it starts to, which is already a very serious issue, but then it starts to increase rapidly from there. And I think all of that could lead severe economic consequences, and at least potentially to something that was quite a bit more serious than we had in the very early 90s.
If that's not reined in, how might those consequences unfold? What's the chemistry? What's the interaction of developments that you fear there?
Well, there are a lot of different possibilities. At least one would be that you begin to have, once this strong private demand for capital, for investment, then at some point, and there's no way to predict when, at some point, that collides with the government's demand for capital to fund its deficit. And the markets begin to look at these endless projected deficits. Interest rates rise very substantially because people see that the imbalance is now an imbalance between supply and demand for capital. Interest rates rise very substantially. The international capital markets at the same time, looking at our very large trade deficit and at our very difficult fiscal conditions, have diminished confidence in our currency so that they demand a higher rate of interest to continue to provide us with their capital. And as you know, we're a savings-deficient country. We need capital flowing in from abroad.
And lots of it.
And unfortunately, very large amounts of it in large measure to fund our fiscal deficit. These things all come back to this fiscal deficit. And all of that causes our economy to slow down very substantially with a loss of jobs, a loss of standard of living, and a long morass until eventually we decide to fix this problem. And to fix it, we're going to have to take very substantial measures, at least for a while. It'll be very painful.
We dug out of it before. You were part of that digging out. It wasn't fun, but it wasn't fatal. So why not again?
Well, that's, I think, what we have to hope will happen. And, of course, it would be far better to do it before you have a period of severe adverse effects than after the adverse effects begin. And with the possibility that the adverse effects this time could be considerably more severe, the measures would have to be more severe, and the difficulty that much greater. Furthermore, as you will remember, Tom, when we did it last time, which was under President Clinton's leadership in 1993, the politics were terrible. We won in the House for our deficit reduction program by 2 votes. In the Senate, it was a tie. The vice president broke the tie. This is very, very difficult to do politically, and it may be that our system would logjam.
Why do you think Washington isn't working more on this now? Why do you think it's not focused more on this now?
Well, somebody who knew Margaret Thatcher very well told me that when she was prime minister, she told him that fiscal discipline is sort of an impossible world for politicians, that they're much happier, it's much more natural to cut taxes and increase spending because that provides immediate gratification. And in effect, the do bill is somewhere down the road, and somebody else is going to have to deal with that problem.
Yes, they will. Yes, they will. Robert Rubin, hold the thought. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with former Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin, a key architect of the 90s boom and economic crisis manager for half the world in the 90s. You can join the conversation. Would you join Robert Rubin in rolling back George W. Bush's tax cuts or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former Clinton Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin, former co-chair of Goldman Sachs, founding director of the National Economic Council, a key architect of the 90s boom, and economic crisis manager for half the world, it seems, sometimes in the 1990s. You can join the conversation tonight. Does the Bush economy need a dose of Rubinomics or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Laura is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just have, I want to know how Mr. Rubin feels about the work of Herman Daly and the school of thought that says there is too much emphasis placed on economic growth and that there should be more emphasis placed on working towards a sustainable economy because, you know, we can't grow forever. Economic resources are not limitless.
Let us pick it up. Thanks, Laura. We've got a Robert Rubin.
Well, I'm unfortunately not familiar with Herman Daly, but I think the concept you've mentioned I'm very familiar with, and I read Tenderness. I relate to it in one respect, but not another. I think that we do have to find a way to reconcile growth and environmental protection, because as you correctly say, we don't have limitless resources, and our very globe itself is not a limitless resource. But I think that is a reconciliation that is possible, so that good environmental policy becomes good economic policy. I think, unfortunately, at the present time, we are rolling back environmental protection. I think that's not only a mistake with respect to our environment, but I think it will undermine us economically for the reasons that you said. We don't have limitless resources.
But Laura also raises the idea that there must be limits to growth, that growth itself is not a recipe that worked perpetually. What do you say to that, Robert Rubin?
Well, I think there are at least two limits to growth. One is you can only grow as rapidly as you can increase your productivity, but you're referring more to the question of the limit of our resources. And I think if you look back over the last, this is at least my view, I think if you look back over the last 100 years, it suggests that every time people have said that our resources are limited, we found a way technologically to deal with that limitation. I'm inclined to think that's probably true going to be true going forward. But I still think your point has a lot of strength to it, and that is that we have to conserve our resources and conserve the planet that we live on. And I think right now we are not focused on that with nearly the intensity we should be. And I think we've rolled back that protection a good long way over the last 3 years.
Laura, thanks for your call. Robert Rubin, you described sitting around not so long ago, as I recall, with Larry Summers, who, of course, is president at Harvard now, and a group, I don't remember who all was there, but a handful of people sitting around trying to get your hands again around the problem of developing economies and how to pull that huge portion of the world's population that makes less than $2 or $1 or something on that scale a day,
right,
up out of that. And you said you came away from that conversation with all that brain power sitting around at leisure with a sense that there's really no consensus and really no conclusion.
Well, I think I just put it slightly differently. You're right, referring to the scene that I set in the book, but I had gone up to Harvard. Larry's now president of Harvard, and I went up to Harvard and with some of our old colleagues from Treasury. We spent about 4 or 5 hours in Larry's president's house talking about this subject. No, I think there's some things that people feel a pretty high degree of confidence about. I think trade integration has helped developing countries very substantially. China has hundreds of millions of people who have been lifted out of poverty as a result and has had very substantial growth rates. India, although not many people have noticed it, India has had very substantial growth over the last 15 years. Market-based economics, I think, have helped. But the fact remains, as you correctly say, that according to the World Bank, about 50% of the world's population still lives on under $2 a day. And the thing the issue that I think is very difficult to come to grips with is how do you deal with countries that, for whatever set of reasons, aren't adopting sensible economic policies, in some cases because of corruption or indifference of the rulers, in other cases just ineffectiveness. And that is a very difficult question to know how to deal with, Tom, because foreign aid isn't going to be effective, or at least not to any great measure, unless it's combined with good policies in the recipient countries. And
so,
that was the issue that everybody has struggled over and nobody has found very good answers to.
So if it's so terribly serious, and of course it is, what about the Wolfowitz approach? Go in and take over and show them a different way.
Well, I don't think I have a lot of views on that, but just in a word, if you're referring to Iraq, that, of course, was not an economic issue. That was a whole other set of issues. And I think at least one comment on that, independently of whether we should have gone into Iraq or we shouldn't have gone into Iraq, independently of that question, I think surely we should have, if we were going to go in, have gone in with a broad-based involvement of many, many other countries. And number two, we should have anticipated the very serious sets of issues that were likely given the history of that part of the world. And once again, I think we could have dealt with them far more effectively had we been allied with a very large number of other countries that could have provided us assistance or worked with us in so many different ways.
But the neocon view that sometimes you just have to go in and change the checkerboard, move the pieces around forcibly, you don't buy it?
I buy that there are times when we have to act forcibly. But I don't think we're going to succeed, Tom, unless we do it in an atmosphere of mutual respect, and unless we do it cooperatively with an awful lot of countries. I think there are times we really have to push the edge of the envelope in providing leadership, but I think that Iraq right now is a good example of how much we need the rest of the world if we're going to succeed. We need their intelligence operations. We need their local knowledge. We need their resources. We need their people. And I think that the success requires American leadership, but I also think it requires a really cooperative working with others in an atmosphere of mutual respect.
Jack is calling from Atlantic Beach, North Carolina. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Mr. Rubin, it's great to hear you. You gave us quite a bit of economic confidence in the last, in the 90s. It was great. I miss it.
Well, thank you.
My question is, with all the talk of the deficits in the future, I know that with our own family budget, you know, we always have to consider, well, you know, I have money to pay bills, but what if somebody gets sick or what if a crisis occurs? Do we take into account a possibility of another 9/11?
Well, that is a very good point. I'm sure you remember all this, but when 9/11 happened, that's really a very interesting point. When 9/11 happened, we had very large budget surpluses that had come out of the 90s, and it gave us the cushion that we needed so that we could vastly increase our expenses on homeland security and defense without creating an upward spike in interest rates that would have had would almost surely have had a very substantial adverse impact on our economy. We've now given up that cushion. We no longer have the flexibility that we had when we had a sound fiscal position. And so if we have to do this again, surely we'll have to do it. But it may come at very substantial economic costs, which we're able to avoid when 9/11, in fact, did happen. And there's one more reason why we've got to get back on a sound long-term fiscal path.
Paint a more concrete scenario there. Without that buffer of surpluses in the face of another event like that, you write about a dinner in a Manhattan restaurant where you sit with a lot of senior professional money managers all talking about terrorism and geopolitical matters, but then when they sat down to do their actual projections, they left it out entirely and acted as though the world was a steady state place without major terrorism. If it did come again without that buffer, how might it play out?
Well, you know, it's hard to know, Tom, because so much depends on the specifics, but it seems to me that it probably would have a substantial adverse impact on confidence, just as 9/11 did, although since people are now attuned to the risks of terrorism, it might have less of an effect. Although it depends what the action was. Let us hope we never have to find out. But if something does happen, I would imagine it will once again be a blow to the psyche. Could also very substantially increase defense expenses and homeland security expenses.
But the distinction being, without that buffer of the surplus,
how would that be then? Well, the difference was that since we had a sound fiscal position and a large surplus, we could draw on that surplus without creating large deficits and without creating an unease in the credit markets that probably would have caused interest rates to go way up. This time we don't have that position. The credit markets are already becoming somewhat uneasy about our long-term deficit, so I don't think that will really create a problem until private demand for capital also goes up. But there's already certainly a very intense cognizance of what we've done to our long-term fiscal situation. So if now we all of a sudden had to very greatly increase our expenses or our costs in the context of this unsound fiscal position, I think that there is probably a relatively high probability you could have a spike up in interest rates, and that, of course, would have a very much of an adverse effect on the economy.
Jack, thank you for your call. Vishnu is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Vishnu. You're on the air.
And I'm calling myself. I'm not sure how good my connection is.
I can't quite hear that.
Yeah, we haven't got you. Are you there, Vishnu?
Yeah, I'm there.
Try it once more.
Can you hear me?
Try it once more.
Hello?
Yes, try it once more.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes, much
yeah,
better.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
Oh dear, I'm sorry, Vishnu. I think you've left our range, and I'm sorry for that. You know, I know what in this case what Vishnu was going to ask, and it was about India and China doing a better job of educating their workers, and how the U.S. economy competes in that circumstance. If he'd been able to ask it, how would you answer, Robert Rubin?
Well, they are doing a lot better job of educating their workers, and the result is they now have literally hundreds of millions of workers who are probably as well educated as ours and as skilled and as able and as productive. And that becomes a new challenge for us in the global economy. The answer, I think, from our point of view is twofold. One, we have to substantially improve our public education system. I think that's an imperative. And secondly, we have to provide training and assistance for those who get dislocated by trade. But I think the wrong answer, which is unfortunately an answer that a lot of people are gravitating toward, is protectionism, because I do believe if we try that route, we will find it enormously counterproductive in terms of consumer prices, the ability of our competitor nations to get inputs to their production processes more cheaply than ours, and retaliation by our trading partners. So protectionism wrong. Improving our own productivity, right.
So no alternative, really, to honestly competing with whatever the competition is.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Although it's also true that as China and India grow, wages will increase rapidly, and they will become the gap will decrease with our wages, number one, and number two, they will become larger and larger markets for our goods.
Robert Rubin, I've got to ask you, you've been at Citigroup since 1999. It's been an eventful period. It hasn't all been pretty. Even Citigroup has taken, you know, taken its hits here. It was part of the almost $1.5 billion SEC settlement in April of this year. In July, Citigroup fined $120 million for helping Enron cook its books. In August, the New York Stock Exchange fined Citigroup for advice it gave to WorldCom. Speak to those issues and corporate governance, corporate responsibility, corporate ethics in the world that I guess you in part helped create.
Well, let me take it away just specifically from Citigroup, if I may, Tom, but I'd be delighted to address the issues. I think I divide them into two pieces. If you look at the conflicts between investment banking and research, I mean, that is a set of issues that clearly needed to be addressed. But it's interesting because that was a set of issues that's been around for a long, long time. The media knew about them. The regulators all knew about them.
The analysts putting out their opinions on companies that the bank was profiting in relationship
with.
No,
I was thinking, I think it was something slightly different, that the analysts – well, yes, but except what was happening was that the analysts were putting out opinions and also helping get investment banking business.
Yeah.
The question
lured
was
in.
Were their opinions affected by their desire to get the investment banking business? And this was an issue that everybody was aware of, but nobody thought about it as a conflict as long as we had this giant bull market that went on from 1982 to, roughly speaking, March of 2000. Once people recognized that this, in fact, was a conflict, and I think there's no question it was a conflict, then the system acted quickly and it was addressed, and I think that problem has been dealt with. In terms of But why nobody recognized it, I can't tell you, Tom. I was part of the industry, but not just me. There was nobody in the industry who thought about that. There was nobody in the regulators. The SEC knew about it. All the attorney generals knew about it. And nobody raised it an issue until the market started to come apart, and then people saw that there was a problem. That is not to say that necessarily it was wrongdoing, but there was an inherent conflict, and there may also have been some wrongdoings. That's a separate matter. The Enron WorldCom, you know, if you look back over American financial history, or for that matter, European or Japanese or whatever, there seem to be periodic spates of these kinds of developments, and I think it is something probably inherent in human nature, and I think there probably is no way to be absolutely foolproof protected against it. But these are very serious problems, an awful lot of people get hurt, and I think the key is to have a system, a regulatory structure that reacts quickly and effectively and deals with them as best it can.
Robert Rubin, you had breakfast for Alan Greenspan once a week for 4 years. If a Democrat should come back to office, David Warsh says you're the next head of the Fed. Are you ready for more public service?
Well, let me say first that we had breakfast with Alan for 4.5 years, actually, the whole time. I was at Treasury with Larry as well, the three of us. That chairmanship will be reappointed during Bush's administration, so he will make the reappointment. In my opinion, it is absolutely clear what he ought to do to reappoint Alan Greenspan.
Ever the diplomat. Robert Rubin, great having you tonight. Thanks so much for being with us.
It was very good to be with you. Thank you very much, Tom.
Robert Rubin, author with Jacob Weisberg of the new book, In an Uncertain World. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.